This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
Compass Media Networks. This is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
When does the nastiness end? I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. First weekend of June. Glad you're on board. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Civil discourse appears to be vanishing. It's hard to hear people disagree these days without the conversation escalating into something uncivilized. But is there an end in sight?
Here come the scammers. As we prepare for our summer vacations, con artists and crooks are waiting for us. Tips on how to avoid them.
What a college student wrote on her application to Yale about pizza deliveries that got her accepted to the Ivy League school.
And the obsession of keeping alive your Snapchat streaks.
I mean, I spoke with Snapchat users who said that, they do this every single day of their lives, and they're often doing them with multiple people. You know, one young girl I interviewed had, I think she had 15 different streaks going at once. So oftentimes they will just send, you know, a picture of the floor, their shoes, the sky, and sometimes they'll just write streak across it.
Wall Street Journal editor Catherine Bindley on the hypermanagement of snap streaks. She's here later in the hour. Well, politeness, decorum, respect all seem to be endangered ideas when it comes to politics these days. The consequences of this trend are real and visible every day in Washington and in state capitals. Wall Street Journal executive Washington editor Jerry Sibes says anybody who isn't troubled isn't really paying attention. Jerry, explain.
Well, I think the biggest eyebrow raiser came in Montana last week when a Republican congressional candidate body slammed a reporter because he didn't like the questioning he was getting, and then was charged with assault and won the election anyway. And so I think that is a pretty good sign of where civil discourse or uncivil discourse, at least in the political realm, has gotten in the country. But you know, that's not the only example. Social media. Go on social media and look at the way people talk to and about each other, and it's sometimes literal threats that are made there, and you get a sense of how far this has spread. And you know, the Democratic Party has responded to some extent in kind, and you have town hall meetings being disrupted, and the state party chairman of California using obscenities both to refer to his own party's protesters and the president at a meeting recently of the state party there. So there are all kinds of examples, but I think the sort of the general decline of conversation and debate in the country has been building for a while, and I think the Trump campaign kicked it into high gear, and that's where we are.
All right, so before we get to the Trump war here, I always point to the anonymity of the internet too, where you could just create some account and just start lobbing bombs, and there's no punishment at all.
Well, I think that's part of it, but I'm not sure that it stops there, because you have a lot of people, you get email and social media threats from anonymous people, and you know that's a phenomenon. But you have you have some things happening now that are not cloaked in anonymity. You had almost a fist fight on the floor of the state Texas state legislature over the weekend because of a dispute about legislation on sanctuary cities and calling immigration agents out to try to arrest protesters and charges of violence being or threats of violence at least being bandied about. And so, you know, this has moved into a different realm, I think, to some extent. So some people are going right at it and not with the cloak of anonymity that social media provides, but just head on.
So are you saying the president of the United States could change the course of
discourse? He could certainly help. You know, I think you have to say that, you know, he shoulders some of the blame for this, a good part of the blame for this, because of the nature of the campaign that he ran last year. You know, he made, you know, insulting his opponents, lying Ted Cruz and crooked Hillary, as kind of a regular feature, and he attacked the press, you know, in the most derogatory terms at his rallies. That got his crowd stirred up, and they sort of, you know, regularly threatened reporters who were there, and you know, basically the campaign got pretty ugly, and everybody kind of knows that. And I think that that was he picked up on a trend that I think has been underway for a couple of years, but he certainly accelerated it, and now I think it's spread further. So if you want to know who can reverse it, I mean, certainly I think any president has the ability to affect the climate in which national conversations take place, and that's true here, but other leaders have the ability to do it as well, and I think some of them probably need to step forward and assert that.
Like who would that be?
Well, you know, if you think about leaders of Congress, you know, who have the ability to say, let's just stop this here, and maybe modeling a different kind of behavior by actually having meaningful conversations with each other about important issues, that would be a good thing. And there's just too little of that right now. But also, I think kind of encouraging people in their own parties to, you know, keep debate in civilized channels and not be intimidated by the shouting that's going on around them. I think that, you know, that's probably not happening very much either.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal Washington executive editor Jerry Seib. His piece is called Civil Discourse in Decline. Where does it end? All right, so we've certainly identified all the problems here. I think we all agree on that. What's the solution?
Well, you know, I'm not sure I know, but I know somebody who's thought about this an awful lot is Father John Jenkins, who's the president of Notre Dame, and who spoke about it a bit at their commencement earlier this month, and who's discussed this. And I called him up and asked him that question: what do we do about this? And he said the first thing is for everybody to recognize that this is a problem and that things have deteriorated, and we can't just become accustomed to it. And then the second thing is that leaders have to be leaders. You know, you have to have some people who rise above this, as he said, and step forward and show us a different way and call people out for this kind of behavior. And that's probably where it starts. The anger out there is in the country on both sides is pretty real. The polarization is very intense, and the Trump phenomenon has made both of those things more acute. But I think that it turns around by people in leadership positions kind of leading the way out of this. Otherwise, I think we descend further, and these signs of violence that you're seeing, it's sad to say, they could proliferate.
Thanks, Jerry. Wall Street Journal Executive Washington Editor Jerry Seib. It's 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. What dad doesn't love to grill, especially when it's a great steak? Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks. And now this Father's Day, for only $49.99, you can get a limited-time Father's Day package when you go to omahasteaks.com and enter DEAL in the search bar. Omaha Steaks even offers online support with recipes and wine pairings. Here's the offer: 80% off Omaha Steaks Father's Day package, which includes 2 tender mild filet mignons, 2 beefy top sirloins, 4 crispy chicken fried steaks, 4 juicy boneless pork chops, 4 all-beef Omaha Steak burgers, 4 gourmet jumbo franks, 12 ounces of all-beef meatballs, 1 pound of steakhouse fries, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, 1 Omaha Steak seasoning packet, plus get 4 additional burgers free. Only $49.99 at omahasteaks.com. Type DEAL in the search bar and add Father's Day package to your cart. This offer ends soon. Go to omahasteaks.com, type DEAL in the search bar, grab your dad and fire up the grill. Hey, don't forget, by the way, to hear a podcast of our weekday program, you can visit our website, which is thismorningwithgordondeal.com. You can also check out places like SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. The weekday program is called This Morning, America's First News. How do you feel about your first name? Do you like it if it's unique, or do you like that it's fairly common? Interesting story about common first names from Sarah Todd, deputy editor of Ideas at the news website Quartz. Sarah, what you put together?
There's been a lot of research showing that people who have unusual names or very unique names can wind up facing some discrimination. People tend to like what they're familiar with. And the upside of a classic biblical name is that it never goes out of style, which means that you're less likely to face bias when you have a name like that.
That's something. I thought it was interesting, too. You point out in the story, someone said there's sort of a different sensitivity today simply because you can Google your name and find out if somebody else has it, and that makes parents uncomfortable. They want their kid to stand out.
Exactly. Yeah, that was something that was really interesting. So I spoke with Laura Wattenberg, who is a baby naming expert, And she was explaining that the rise of the internet really changed the way that we think about names. Part of it is because now we have search engines, so we can type a name into Google and realize, whereas before we might not know that there were 100 other Sarah Todds, now I'm very much aware of all the Sarah Todds out there. In fact, there's one who's an Instagram model. So that's definitely a lot to live up to.
That's funny. We're speaking with Sarah Todd at Quartz. She's deputy editor of Ideas, and she's written a piece called The Psychological Effects of Growing Up with an Extremely Common Name. When I first saw the headline, I thought, psychological effects? Boy, are people being destroyed or distraught somehow over the name? But I don't think you quite went that far.
Yeah, not at all. I think I was more curious in just exploring what people's feelings are. I think we've heard a lot about how people with very unusual names think about growing up. They might get bullied or teased at school. They might take pride in it because it kind of showcases their family's history and their unique culture. So I spoke with some other Sarahs. I kind of took a sample poll and found it seems like what the most common thing is, if you have a name like Sarah or John, these really like very generic classic names, is that you feel a sense of detachment from it. People tend to feel less ownership over their names, whereas I think if you have a name like, say, Nora, not a crazy name, but just a slightly more unusual name, you identify more closely with it.
I was fascinated by the one point in your story where you talk about how other countries, like you mentioned Denmark and Iceland, they kind of restrict the names you can choose from. You have to have a name from a government-approved list.
Exactly. Yeah. And those are not the only countries. There are a lot more. Sweden and Norway regulate baby names. France used to. I believe Portugal still does. So these countries, the idea is often to protect children from schoolyard bullying and sort of like the headache of having to spell your name out over and over again. I also mentioned in passing in the article that in Denmark in particular, there's this idea of jantelov, the idea of aspiring to be average, and then you're happier when ordinary things happen to you in your life. Jeez. So I think the idea of sort of limiting the pool of names is in keeping with that idea, whereas in the U.S. and to some extent in the U.K., people are more concerned with standing out.
Why did you mention in the story that your father used to call you by your full name? Why was that?
Indeed, and he still does this to this very day. I think that was because, you know, I talk about in the story, I was always surrounded by Sarahs. I remember in preschool there were at least four other ones. And we would sometimes be distinguished by our initials of our last names. But even that, sometimes there were two Sarah T's. So I think my dad got used to hollering Sarah Todd just so that I would pay attention and look up from my playgroup and run over to him. And he did it even when we were alone as well. So even in his phone, I'm listed as Sarah Todd.
Good sense of humor. Sarah Todd, deputy editor of Ideas at the news website Quartz. It's 21 minutes after the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. As school ends and summer arrives, so does vacation time. And guess who else is watching the calendar? Thieves, crooks, con artists. Here's how to avoid them on vacation from this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
It's summer, which means it's scam time. Whether you're home or traveling, there are a few things you should be aware of. Consumer advocate Christopher Elliott joins us now with some tips. Christopher, how can you get scammed when making home improvements?
There are so many ways. I've been scammed myself. One of the worst home improvement scams is the guy who shows up and gives you an estimate, and then he runs off with the money after you've paid him a non-refundable deposit. And that actually happened to me on a fence repair that I was doing a couple of years back, where I paid the guy and then he was gone. He actually skipped town and left and took my money with him. So there's so many different variations of this out there, but you know, you want to be dealing with a reputable contractor when you're ordering your work. And a lot of people just go with the lowest bidder, which sometimes is a huge mistake.
So should you get recommendations from friends and family?
Absolutely. With a contractor, you want to ask around, ask friends and family if they've dealt with someone that they like. There are also several different online resources that you can use, you know, Angie's List, places like that. Finally, when you do meet that person and they give you a bid, ask them for a list of references of people that they've worked with. And all those things can protect you. It's not a guarantee, but it can protect you from having shoddy work or, worse yet, no work done on your home.
Now, Chris, of course, a lot of people move in the summer. A lot of homes are closed on during the summer months. What are some of the issues with moving companies?
Moving companies are regulated at the federal level, and you can go to the DOT website and find out which ones are legit and which ones are not legit. But a lot of times you have a situation where they'll give you a low bid to move. They'll pack up all your things, and then when you move into your home, they'll tell you that you owe a balance, and they will not release the furniture until and the other goods that you have until you pay that balance. And it's a little bit like taking your personal belongings hostage. And I've actually dealt with several cases like that where, and it's just really, really difficult with these unscrupulous movers to really get anything. They want your money.
Do you have any recourse in a situation like that? Do you have to end up suing them in small claims court or something like that?
Yeah, that's one possibility. You know, the other one is that you can complain to regulators. Again, they're regulated at the state level and at the federal level, too, especially if they're doing interstate transactions, so if they're going across state lines. And those are, you know, really important things to know. But, you know, you don't have to go to court. A lot of times, a little pressure on social media or even a politely worded letter of complaint or inquiry is enough to get the moving company to do the right thing.
We're speaking with consumer advocate Christopher Elliott. Chris, what about travel clubs? Are they worth it?
No, absolutely not. In fact, the only travel club that I know of that's worth joining is AAA. And it doesn't really function like the travel clubs that I cover on my website. That's Elliott.org. You know, the travel clubs are so funny. They incorporate in states where regulations are loose, and they will go to set up a shop in a mini mall and do these high-pressure presentations, tell you that you can save thousands of dollars off your next vacation if you just join now. The memberships are often outrageous. We're talking about thousands, even tens of thousands of dollars for an annual membership, and they are absolutely worthless. And I hear from people all the time who say, they've sat through one of these presentations, it sounds good, what do you think? I tell them, don't walk away, run.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with consumer advocate Christopher Elliott. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. It's Small Business Month, and Dell is celebrating innovators and job creators in a big way, like up to 40% off business PCs big. Even a free 1 terabyte external hard drive with select purchases big. Call 877-BUY-DELL today to connect with a U.S.-based advisor. They're ready to help with tech solutions tailored to your business, like finding just the right Dell PCs with Intel Core processors, because your hard work is more than appreciated, it's admired. Call 877-BUY-DELL today.
Ransomware is software that can infiltrate your business through email, enabling cyber criminals to hijack sensitive information as ransom for your own data's release. Leveraging Barracuda email security with advanced threat detection can stop a ransomware attack in its tracks. As an added measure, Barracuda Backup allows you to recover your data without having to surrender to extortion. Crime doesn't pay when you protect your business data with Barracuda. Go to Barracuda.com/ransomware to learn more.
Thanks for being with us on this first weekend in June. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka coming up this half hour. How to thrive when a robot comes for your job. Also, the obsessions people have with keeping alive their Snapchat streaks, or snap streaks as they're called. And Ivy League admission, easy as pizza pie. That story in about 20 minutes. The tally of 49 people shot over Memorial Day weekend in Chicago, historically one of the most violent times of the year there, is oddly perhaps the latest sign that the city might be turning a corner in the fight against gun violence. It's a story from Amar Madhani, national correspondent at USA Today. He's based in Chicago. Amar, this is considered progress?
It's grim progress, I guess. As you guys well know, it's been a tough 17 months in Chicago. Last year, there was more than 760 killed, and we're nearing 240 killed in the first 5 months of 2017. So you're talking about 1,000 people killed in the last 17 months. And those numbers are awful. But in the midst of that, there are some small signs, at least the police think, that the city may be turning the corner and lowering or reducing the gun violence. Fatal shootings are down about 6%. Shooting incidents themselves are down about 15%. And with the help of technology in a couple of the worst neighborhoods, they're seeing the best gains, with violence down in two of the essentially five districts of Chicago count for a disproportionate number of the murders. In two of those districts where they've installed some new technology, they've seen drops of 30% and 40%, and police are now hoping that essentially that this might be the magic wand that they're looking for.
Wow. All right. So you mentioned these data-driven nerve centers, right? Video sensors and other technology. Is that directly responsible?
I think that's in part greater visibility. You know, the other factor, just talking to some police officials, is that confidence is starting to rise again amongst the rank and file. If you remember back, you know, end of 2015, the Laquan McDonald video came out in Chicago, and a police officer named Jason Van Dyke was charged with first-degree murder for shooting a young man named Laquan McDonald, who was armed with a small knife 16 times as he appeared to be running away from police. That caused a lot of protests, caused an extraordinary amount of angst and political pressure for Mayor Rahm Emanuel, led to the ouster of the police superintendent at the time, Gary McCarthy, and voters voting the Cook County state's attorney out of office. Time has passed. You know, there's undoubtedly, I'm not trying to downplay that there's still rancor in the African-American community and the police force, but I do think that, at least talking to some police officials here, that time is getting, you know, cops in a better frame of mind. And, you know, the idea of the Ferguson effect that's taken over in large parts of the nation, perhaps that's fading here in Chicago, and we have more engaged police officers. But the numbers are still terrible.
Right. We're speaking with Amar Madhani, national correspondent at USA Today. He's written a piece called 49 Shot in Chicago over Memorial Day weekend, and that's a sign of progress. You mentioned before, like, so much of this in the Black and Latino neighborhoods is tied to gang violence. Has there been any way to address that, or is this just purely a numbers game in stopping homicides?
So, you know, I think from the political standpoint, the police superintendent and the mayor, Emanuel, complained that gun laws are too lax here, that essentially there isn't any disincentive if you're a repeat offender from not picking up a gun when you're on the outside, when you get out of jail, because it's a slap on the wrist, that they feel that the gun laws are not strong enough in pushing folks to think twice about picking up a gun. And there's some movement in the state legislature that would tighten gun laws, where essentially it would strengthen the sentence, minimum sentence, to about 7 years from 3 years for a repeat gun offender. And if a judge decides to give a sentence less than 7 years, they would have to explain in writing why.
Thanks, Amar. Amar Madhani, national correspondent at USA Today, based in Chicago. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. How prepared are you to compete with a robot for your job? New America, a think tank, is in the midst of a big study on the future of work, and the outlook is not comforting. They predict a further decline of good-paying jobs that support middle-class lives. And what people need to know is how to prepare for what might come. Here's Yahoo Finance writer Rick Newman. Rick, what are you hearing?
Well, I was at this big gathering of business and finance leaders called the Milken Institute Global Conference recently out in Los Angeles, and there was tons of discussion about what are we going to do when there just are no jobs left because robots and software do it all. You know, some of it was sort of doomy and gloomy, you know, lots of worries about social unrest and things like that. But some people said, you know, look, there actually are some things we can all be doing now. And by the way, this is not necessarily just something likely to happen in the future. I mean, this is happening now. We know a lot of jobs on factory floors, for example, are done by machines and robotic contraptions and things like that. So, you know, I've just been paying a lot of attention to people who are trying to think about what's going to happen here with this trend.
What can't robots do, I guess?
Robots cannot yet do things that require human touch. Healthcare is an example. All kinds of care, actually. Child care, elder care. Now, there are people, there is actually, believe it or not, such a thing as an elder care robot.
Oh, boy.
That can help with some tasks, but you know, there still are jobs that require, you know, just require human involvement, salesmanship, you know, things that involve relating to people. And there are still programming and technical jobs that robots can't do yet. People think that as this thing called artificial intelligence improves, you know, robots will be able to do better these things. And, you know, the real question is, will robots replace human workers, or will humans find new ways to take advantage of robots and create new forms of work? And that's one of the big questions here.
All right. So one of the guys you talked to said you start developing your side hustle, meaning what?
Yeah. Have a day job and then something else. Get ready for a work environment where, you know, one job alone may not do it, or, you know, a job may only be relevant for 3 or 4 years, and you're going to have to learn new skills. I mean, a lot of this is, you know, these are sort of trends that have been underway for a long time, and they've sort of been moving slowly, and I think you could say these trends have accelerated in recent years. So a lot of this is not really that new, but it's becoming increasingly urgent for people to think this way. Older workers, for example, the idea that you're just going to kind of coast along on whatever you've been doing for the last 15 or 20 years, that is not necessarily true. And if you find you might have to work another 5 or 10 years, what are you going to do? Well, the idea is start developing some new skills now, you know, start learning new things, make sure you have at the bare minimum familiarity with digital technology, the ability to work with different kinds of digital technology apps, and that you're, you know, doing a pretty good job of keeping up with what's new.
Thanks, Rick. Yahoo Finance writer Rick Newman, who's based in New York. 14 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for 3 straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in defense, cybersecurity, mobility, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan among the top 10 states in the country for business. To learn more, visit michiganbusiness.org. Glad you could be with us. If you've got a Snapchat account or have kids in the house who do, like me, you're aware of Snapchat streaks, where you maintain a relationship with someone for as many days in a row as possible on the app. Wall Street Journal news editor Catherine Bindley says some Snapchatters go to extreme lengths to keep their daily message streaks from disappearing. One miss and you have to start again. Catherine, set this up.
The way this works is that you have two people who start sending snaps to one another, and snaps count as either photos or videos. It cannot be just a regular chat text type message. And within these messages, these photos and videos, users will often add different lenses, as Snapchat calls them, which might, you know, make a photo of you look like a dog or like a cat, or they have all kinds of funny filter-like things that people will put on their snaps. And when you send one to a friend and they send one back to you within 24 hours, that's sort of the first day of what would ultimately become a streak, assuming you can keep it going for 3 days. Once you've hit 3 days, you get a flame emoji next to the chat thread that you're in with your friend, and then it keeps count. And as long as each of you exchange messages, once within 24 hours, then your streak will stay alive.
I can always tell when my son is in the middle of some streak he's trying to keep alive, because he takes a selfie that includes like the quarter of his forehead and then just like the wall behind him. It's just some meaningless picture, right, that just counts as keeping the streak alive.
Yes, there will be, I spoke with Snapchat users who said that, they do this every single day of their lives, and they're often doing them with multiple people. So, one young girl I interviewed had, I think she had 15 different streaks going at once. So oftentimes they will just send, a picture of the floor, their shoes, the sky, and sometimes they'll just write streak across it so that whoever the recipient is knows, like, hey, I'm just sending this to keep our streak alive.
How about the couple you found that had the streak going and then they lost it for some reason? They actually contacted Snapchat support desk and they gave them like a one-time courtesy?
That's correct. So what's funny about the two of them is that they were together when they noticed that their streak had expired, and one would assume that, you know, you don't need to text or snap someone who you've been with the whole day, but you actually have to do that if you want to keep your streak alive. So they both just, they'd gotten to Samantha's house and looked down, and she was like, oh my God, our snap streak is gone. And he checked his phone and saw that the streak was gone. And she said they were initially kind of joking about it, saying, she was like, oh, you know, Snapchat support is probably for people with real problems. And then her boyfriend said, well, what if we actually email them? And they did. And Snapchat, you know, would not disclose to us how they determine whose streaks get restored. But Samantha, the young woman featured in the story, did send me, you know, proof of the email from Snapchat that they had granted them this one-time courtesy and gave them their streak back. And so now it's still going strong somewhere it's at 300-something days now. So they've been snapping one another every day for over a year, minus the one day when they forgot.
I'm sorry. That has to get an asterisk. That's not fair. I don't like getting that one-time exemption. I don't care if it's Snapchat or not. It's Wall Street Journal news editor Catherine Binley. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. A Tennessee teenager's love for pizza has delivered acceptance at Yale University to her door. The Tennessean reports that a young woman named Carolina Williams from Ravenwood High School in the Nashville suburbs was accepted to the Ivy League school in March, with an admissions officer noting her standout answer to a short essay prompt to write about something she loves to do. What'd she write about? Ordering pizza from Papa John's. Ms. Williams says her answer was the first thing that came to mind. By the way, she also ranked in the top 10 of her graduating class and participated in multiple extracurricular activities. Among the essay highlights, quote, "Accepting those warm cardboard boxes at my front door is second nature to me, but I will always love ordering pizza because of the way 8 slices of something so ordinary are able to evoke feelings of independence, consolation, and joy." By the way, she'll be the first in her family to go to college, but she said thanks but no thanks to Yale. She'll pursue business at Auburn University, saying she felt it was a better fit, and she liked the scholarships. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.